ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. This week, after several delayed starts and stops, I'll finally be joined by special guest Terrence Johnson, who's going to visit the magical plantation of Terra with me to discuss 1939's Gone with the Wind.
Gone with the Wind has captured the imagination and acclaim of the entire world. The screen has never known a love story to compare with this, when Rhett Butler meets Scarlett O'Hara.
I love you more than I've ever loved any woman. And I've waited longer for you than I've ever waited for any woman.
Let me alone!
A love affair you'll remember as long as you live, filled with all the fire and fury of the times in which it happened. Gone with the Wind. First picture to win 10 Academy Awards. The most honored, the most talked about motion picture in all film history.
Before becoming the landmark picture that it is today, Gone with the Wind initially started with the 1,037-page book of the same name by author Margaret Mitchell. Mitchell was a Southerner of prominent parentage, born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia. Like many authors from the South, Mitchell was enchanted and intrigued by a world that seemingly had existed only in fantasy. In 1926, she left her job as a reporter for the Atlanta Journal and started working on the story that would cement her legacy. Gone with the Wind is the tale of the spoiled Southern belle Scarlett O'Hara, and how she navigates the Civil War, as well as restoring the legacy of her ancestral home Tara, and winning the love of the wily Rhett Butler. Published in 1936, the book became a bestseller. As of 2014, it was still listed in polls as the second favorite book of American readers, just behind the Bible. 30 million copies have been printed worldwide. Margaret Mitchell received the Pulitzer Prize for her work in 1937. In July of 36, a month after the book's publication, Hollywood came calling to turn Mitchell's book into the grandest, most epic production that is yet to be recreated.
As God is my witness, as God is my witness, they're not going to lick me. I'm going to live through this, and when it's all over, I'll never be hungry again. No, nor any of my folk. If I had to lie, steal, cheat, or kill, as God is my witness, I'll never be hungry again.
MGM and RKO both considered buying the rights to Mitchell's tome. Warner Brothers' grand dame, Betty Davis, wasn't interested in the film, causing that studio to let the book pass them by. Funnily enough, Davis would end up making two movies with their roots heavily steeped in Gone with the Wind, All This and Heaven 2, and Jezebel, as an apology for passing this up. It was David O. Selznick who bought the rights for $50,000, small potatoes in today's multi-million dollar movie world. Production was difficult, to say the least. It took nearly 2 years for Clark Gable to even agree to be a part of the production, and it was only because he needed money to pay for a divorce. Screenwriter Sidney Howard refused to leave England to work on the script, and a host of writers, including the acclaimed Ben Hecht, would revise his work to get things to a suitable length. Director George Cukor was initially offered the position of helming the film, but after 3 weeks into filming, Selznick fired him, presumably because Clark Gable didn't want a known homosexual director of women's pictures to be the one in charge of him, and this was over the protestations of Vivian Leigh and Olivia de Havilland. Victor Fleming, who was simultaneously working on The Wizard of Oz, was called in to take over the production. He'd be temporarily replaced by Sam Wood after the stress of making both major movies caused Fleming to have a bit of a nervous collapse. These issues were nothing, though, compared to finding the right woman to play Scarlett O'Hara. In what was touted as the biggest casting call of all time, over 1,400 women auditioned for the role of Scarlett, including every actress currently working in the studio at the time. Just a few of the women who auditioned: Joan Crawford, Lana Turner, Miriam Hopkins, and Paulette Goddard. Hopkins was considered Mitchell's choice for the role, but it was little-known English actress Vivian Leigh who won the part. This after being turned down to play Kathy opposite her lover Laurence Olivier in his film, Wuthering Heights.
Red, where are you going?
I'm going to Charleston, back where I belong.
Please take me with you.
No, I'm through with everything here. I want peace. I want to see if somewhere there isn't something left in life of charm and grace.
Do you know what I'm talking
no.
about?
No. I only know that I love you.
That's your misfortune.
Oh, Red, you go. Where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Gone with the Wind had its grand premiere on December 15, 1939, at the Lowe's Grand Theater in Atlanta. Over 30,000 people attended the culmination of 3 days of festivities, though star Hattie McDaniel was barred from the event, as were the rest of the black cast members, due to George's Jim Crow laws. The film received excellent notices, with critics dazzled by the ambition of the production, though several were turned off by the runtime. At the 12th Academy Awards in 1940, Gone with the Wind set the record for wins and nominations at that time, winning 8 awards out of the 13 categories it was nominated in. It would win Best Picture, Best Director, Actress for Vivien Leigh, Supporting Actress for Hattie McDaniel, marking her as the first black woman to win an Oscar, Best Adapted Screenplay, Color Cinematography, Editing, and Art Direction. It also garnered 2 honorary awards for William Cameron Menzies Color Cinematography, that was already on top of the color cinematography win, and to Selznick International Pictures for making the film in the first place. Talk about praise. Unfortunately, Gigi and Ben-Hur would later break Gone with the Wind's win record. Gone with the Wind has been reevaluated by critics and scholars at several points since, with many decrying its depictions of black slaves and women. But its power endures to this day in spite of its flaws, and it still remains one of the most epic films ever produced. When we come back, guest Terrence Johnson and I delve further into Gone with the Wind.
Tara is from which you get your strength. The Red Earth of Tara.
Why, land's the only thing that matters.
Something you love better than me.
The Red Earth of Tara.
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 Home. I'll go home. And I'll think of some way to get him back. After all, tomorrow is another day.
Today I'm talking with the fantabulous Terrence Johnson. Terrence, how are you today?
I am doing good. It's a little chilly, but other than that, I am great.
Terrence, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
My name is Terrence. I do live in Los Angeles. I run LenoirTour.net, where I post about stuff, Shadowhunters mostly, because I've been doing recaps for that. I am also writing for Screen Rant, and Kristen and I are former award circuit buddies. Now we do our own little podcast about every 2 weeks, and we're talking about one of my favorite films of all time today, so I knew I had to jump on this.
Yes, Terrence was the one who said we needed to talk about Gone with the Wind, mostly because
I could not believe that you did not like this movie.
Let's start with that. You're aware that I dislike Gone with the Wind, so maybe give us a nice little rundown of why you love Gone with the Wind so much.
Gone with the Wind, maybe more than any movie ever made, really exemplifies the height of studio system power. When I think of a big epic sweep of a movie, Gone with the Wind is the thing that first pops up to my mind. I think it is brilliant filmmaking by all, 750 directors that happened to work on this. This movie had a lot of directors. I think that the performances are great. It's like this time capsule of what was one of the greatest years for cinema. It has its problems, but I think the problems make it perfect in a way. We can talk about them as we go on to this. And Vivien Leigh, she carries it. So I love it. Love, love, love it.
To give the similar rundown, I don't hate Gone with the Wind. Mm-hmm. I fall into the camp of many critics who say it's overrated. And Technically, it's flawless. The cinematography, the score, the costuming, the set design, it is a beautiful film. Probably one of the most beautiful films we've ever had. It's filmed beautifully. The script is what it is. My issue is more with character motivation, length predominantly. And I know we just did an episode about Dial M for Murder, talking about how it was too talky. So I'm sure somebody listening to this is going to say, First, they complained about Dial M for Murder being too talky. Now she's complaining about Gone with the Wind being too long. I always say you have to have a lot to justify more than a 2-hour runtime. And this definitely has a lot of stuff to boast nearly a 4-hour runtime. But I just think there are so many moments where you can easily zone out and just pay half attention to it. I call Scarlett O'Hara the Nomi Malone of 1930s cinema. If you've seen Showgirls, you know what I mean in terms of the fact that she is a horrible character who does horrible things, and yet everybody seems to want to help her.
She is very... I was thinking about this, and I was comparing it a lot to The Great Gatsby, in that Gone with the Wind is filled with terrible people being terrible to each other.
It really, really is. And I'm sure somebody's going to say that this isn't a detriment, but the characters, I think, are cleanly divided into black and white, other than Scarlett and maybe Rhett, who have a little shade of gray in them every now and then.
Yeah.
A lot of the issues anyone could bring up are stuff that's inherent in the book, which we'll talk about, the slavery narrative, the fact that the Confederacy is heroic and the Yankees are lecherous thieves. You and I both hate Leslie Howard in this movie, which we will have a whole moment to hate on Leslie Howard. I do love Olivia de Havilland. I will say that woman is flawless, even though she is the living embodiment of an angel in this movie who does nothing wrong and doesn't really have much of a personality other than being good.
What juxtaposition with Scarlett.
I've written stuff that uses the word hate and Gone with the Wind in the same sentence, but I think having seen it now more than once, and yes, I have seen this more than once in case somebody says, did you just watch it once and you decided you hated it? No, I've seen this more than once as both a film viewer and in an academic setting. I can't say that I despise it, but it's a chore for me to actually sit and watch.
Very long. I remember I saw it in college for the first time, and I remember, but before that, I was like, I can't, 4-hour, what? With an intermission.
This movie, I think, justifies epic status more than something like Ben-Hur. When I talked about the 59 version of Ben-Hur, if I didn't bring it up the first time, I might have brought it up the second time we recorded that episode, but it's a very long movie, and I don't think that the length is justified by the story. Here, I understand the length justifying the story. Now, keep in mind, I have never read the book. The book is very long, too. I don't know if I hate this, but it's definitely, I always say, now whether it's a movie I'd watch on a Sunday, it's not something I'd pop in.
And even for me, I mean, I love it. You have to actually dedicate time. I mean, when I first saw it, it was on TCM, and they played with the overture and the intermission and the exit music, so I was really sitting there for 4 hours.
They aired this recently for their 31 days of Oscar, and I think it was pretty much the whole day.
I like that they do it like that, because you should experience the movie how it was made, and yes, it was made to be long.
The TCM, the film festival, has shown this. And it's one of those things, I could never devote taking a whole day out of a film festival setting to go see this. I promise this episode won't be nearly as long as the movie itself, but let's talk about the creation of this, because you and I were talking about the creation of another movie before this recording, and this movie has an equally lengthy production history with a big budget, and this movie created countless imitations, had easily, 15 directors at a certain point.
Yeah.
That just came and went. This is credited to Victor Fleming.
Yes.
Who, if memory serves, also dabbled with The Wizard of Oz and then left.
But he's credited with that, too.
I'm going to get directors mixed up because everybody came and went this production. But you also had George Cukor was credited, and George Cukor was a woman's director. There were also issues, supposedly, that Clark Gable did not like George Cukor because he was gay. And Sam Wood is also credited on here, which he's kind of the outlier, because I always see Sam Wood as Journeyman's director on this. I see the Victor Fleming imagery. I mean, he's definitely had his fair share of big opulent productions. I can only imagine just showing up one day and having one director, coming back the next day, you have another one. And then, hey, there's a third one that pops up now.
And they had multiple cinematographers on the project. I mean, I joked about having 750 at the beginning of this, but it really, like in reference of Titanic, which is another big Oscar-winning epic sweep movie, and how it was like the Titanic of its day, with all of its production issues and things. And it's really fascinating to watch this movie knowing that. Because you can tell when the style shifts. They managed to weave it in well with the story, but you can definitely tell those early scenes of terror are directed by somebody different than the stuff that's in the house when Scarlett and Rhett are now living together and parents.
I think everything is remarkably opulent, but there is this tendency to... You can see some cinematographers trying to show the expanse, and then others trying to deal with the interiority of the plantation scenes.
Yeah.
And the burning of Atlanta is just this sweeping shot, or the scenes of all the soldiers. There are some beautiful wide shots, but then you also have these small little scenes of Scarlett in the plantation that just feel like they easily are shot by somebody different.
For me, I look at that as part of the greatness of the movie, that I can still enjoy it even with those stylistic shifts. But
yeah.
I know for a lot of people that's sort of a thing that detracts from the film.
And as many directors as we had a lot of actresses who auditioned for the role of Scarlett O'Hara. You were an actress in the 1930s. You auditioned for Scarlett O'Hara. There's the whole movie called, what is it, The Scarlett O'Hara War, that is a made-for-TV film that I want to say I've reviewed, that breaks down who was considered, but everybody and their sister was considered for this movie, literally. Bette Davis was considered for this role. Lucille Ball auditioned for it. Katharine Hepburn, who had worked with George Cukor before, was auditioning. Joan Crawford, which that would have been interesting. Lana Turner, that would have been something, because her and Clark Gable ended up having an affair, which... Clark Gable kind of guilted himself for the fact that Carol Lombard, who was his wife at the time, died in a plane crash because she was coming back to reconcile with him after he had slept with Lana Turner. Jean Harlow, the aforementioned Carol Lombard audition, who supposedly got the closest, was Paulette Goddard. And presumably she was the choice for everybody, but she was in this illicit relationship with Charlie Chaplin. They couldn't prove that she was actually married to him, though, and they thought that it would be a morality issue. So she says that that's what ruined it for her. There are other people that say she was not that close. We'll never really know.
You can't be messy in your personal life. I just saw that Susan Hayward was also up for the role, and I love her.
Just thinking of Bette Davis in the 1930s and Joan Crawford in the 1930s, Joan Crawford would have been a little too hard scrabble. And you need somebody that's obviously never worked a day in their life to play Scarlett. Bette Davis, if you watch something like Jezebel, which was her attempt to cash in on the Gone with the Wind franchise, tries a little too hard to be matronly. Vivian Leigh is probably the best cast.
Yeah.
My issues are not with Vivian Leigh's performance. They're with the character.
This and A Streetcar are perfect bookends to a career.
Oh, yes.
They're two Oscar wins. They are my top two favorite actress wins of all time. What I love so much about her performance and the character, Scarlett is so interesting because she's very unlikable on the surface, very unlikable underneath as well. But by positioning her as a woman within this sort of world, I think you root for her despite all that unlikability. I was thinking about this earlier today in advance of us talking and wondering if Scarlett was a man, if the story was about a man, one, it wouldn't work, but two, we would not even care what happened to her because she's a woman. She makes some piss poor decisions. I love this movie, but Scarlett's incessant chasing after Ashley Wilkes is one of the most frustrating things I think I've ever witnessed in a movie. I love that character. I love that she wasn't afraid to be unlikable, and it pays off for me.
I'm one of the first people to say difficult women in Hollywood, it's a double standard. You can be a difficult man in Hollywood and get to the top. You can be a difficult woman in Hollywood and your career will die a slow, painful death. And we saw that a lot. We still see that now with actresses. So Vivian Leigh is amazing in this movie. It took me a while because I saw this in my teens. It took me a while till I realized that she was actually English.
Yes.
I was completely fooled. I think that accent is perfect. And she looks great. I love when she's the petulant Scarlett, when she's acting like a child. And she's that little girl that constantly needs the scolding. But then the movie takes this turn and she actually has to use the expression man up and get stuff done. You probably wouldn't complain if she figured out how to get Tara back. And I do think the movie, if anything, punishes her for her actions a bit too harshly, because there's no spoilers, because at this point, if you haven't seen the movie, but the death of Bonnie Blue, her daughter, I call her Bonnie Bell because I think of the smacker. You're just sitting there thinking, okay, yeah, she's a pain. I despise her, but we just, like, kill off this child. She's dead. Yeah. And you're sitting there thinking, okay, but then Rhett is really the only one that shows any real significant emotion over her death. I'm not saying she had to drop to her knees and throw her arms up in the air and be all, why? But she's a little too Lady Macbeth by that point.
I agree. Because it feels more like a ploy to get her to see Rhett's love and as we're moving towards the ending and his reaction to it.
You brought up, is Gone with the Wind a feminist film? Do you think it is?
I think the story in itself is inherently feminist. And that's why I mentioned if she was a man, we wouldn't think twice about her slapping her sister and telling her to get it together or taking control of Tara or swindling people left and right. We wouldn't say that. I think her unlikability is what makes it feminist, and that she gets to make as many choices as possible within this world that it just is not here for the women.
Yeah, you can really play this up against something like a Pre-Code, something like Jean Harlow and Redheaded Woman, where the characters were unrepentant about their behavior, and the movie at that point was allowed to celebrate them, or someone like Barbara Stanwyck in Babyface, if you take out the coda of that movie, which tries to give her some redemption at the end. She doesn't really need it. I would agree. She's a character that starts out as a very flighty, boy-crazy, petulant little girl. She does figure out that she has to use her feminine wiles. She's still allowed to be feminine in certain instances, where she goes to the party after her husband has died. She still wants to dance, even though that's meant to be the slight against her.
That's one of my favorite moments in the movie, is her and Red dancing.
Yeah, her feet are just moving behind the counter. But then you have this whole women helping women thing. That's what I always want to promote with talking about feminism in cinema. And Scarlett O'Hara doesn't have time for lady friends because she's trying to snake Ashley Wilkes from Olivia de Havilland's character, Melanie. She's just mean to her the entire time. Melanie has a baby and they have to shove her in the back of this wagon. And
yes, as they try to get out of Atlanta.
She just had a baby 10 minutes ago. But then when Melanie is dying, she's like, take care of Ashley for me. I'm sitting there thinking, no, she should have grabbed Scarlett by the collar and been like, I knew everything.
Melanie either is, you mentioned she's the embodiment of an angel, but I think that was such a good thing for them to do, that had she recognized it and thrown it back in Scarlett's face, it wouldn't have been as compelling. Scarlett is very young. Isn't she like 13 to 16 or something like that when the story starts? Super, super young. And she's still making all of these foolish decisions. I do think that's a feminist picture, with the exception of one thing.
I'm thinking that one thing is the thing that I brought up to.
Yes. That's the one. Who but a feminist could show up to jail in a dress made entirely out of curtains?
She's so resourceful, and we would not have someone like Princess Giselle in Enchanted making a dress out of curtains if we didn't have this. She makes the declaration that she's never gonna go hungry again. That's a very human moment. It's not defined by gender, it's just a person's will to survive. And she comes up with all these ingenious ways of doing things, and you can obviously see why someone like Rhett Butler would be attracted to her. Mm-hmm. Because of her spunkiness and her feistiness. And I'm not understanding why on God's green earth she would want Ashley Milquetoast Wilkes. We'll get to that. The relationship that is the most interesting from a feminist perspective is Scarlett and Hattie McDaniel's characters.
Mm-hmm.
There is so much to just deconstruct. Hattie McDaniel won an Oscar for this.
Yes. She wasn't going to be allowed to go to the premiere until Clark Gable was like, well, I'm not going to show up.
They did this big roadshow premiere. She either wasn't allowed or she had to sit in a separate section. And Hattie McDaniel does so good in a role that, if you watch a lot of classic films from that time period, you see a couple glimmers of positive roles for people of color. It's not often, though, up until you get into, like, the 70s. You look at someone like Mae West, who actually let her aides be in her movies, who were black women. She let them be in. She said that that was what she wanted. She wanted them in her movies. Barbara Stanwyck also did that as well. She wanted roles for women of color in her films. And It's a far cry from some of the other movies that I've seen that just have horrible depictions of black people. I always bring up Holiday Inn. There's a lot of criticism, both for and against, the film's depictions of slavery and the slaves and Hattie McDaniel's performance. I think Hattie McDaniel is amazing. Where do you fall?
I had all of those things in mind when I first saw it. I agree with many of the criticisms. I think that she just comes into the movie and she's just a force. Vivian Leigh is tearing everybody up on her way throughout the movie, but she can't do that to Hattie, and in some respects she can't do that to Clark Gable. And so it's really fascinating to see her have this scene partner who, whether or not slaves actually acted like that to their owners or dealt like that with the younger people of the family, it's really interesting to see her inhabit that role. I think of it as an early precursor to Octavia Spencer in The Help, not in a negative way, but just in some ways there's, and even though it may be stereotypical, in some ways there's strength in that power of being like, I might be this maid, but what won't happen is X, Y, and Z. Scarlett trying to go out to that barbecue with the dress hanging off her shoulders and her being like, this is not happening, is a great moment.
I've read a lot of criticism saying that her character is the precursor to the quote-unquote sassy black woman trope that we see. I can see how people would see that. It's great that you bring up Octavia Spencer because we see Scarlett's mother in this movie.
Yes.
Scarlett's mother's not really a whole lot to write home about. She's not really a maternal presence in any sense.
Real absent.
Very much so. Whereas Hattie McDaniel's character is really the only mother that Scarlett has ever known. If you really think about it, it comes from a place of love, not master-slave type of love, but the concept of two women who have grown together and one's been raised by the other and can appreciate that. The character I always am interested to hear people talk about is Butterfly McQueen's character.
Ugh, I can't stand.
Okay, I know everybody loves the scene where Melanie is giving birth and everybody loves to quote,
I don't know nothing about birth and no babies. That one, yeah.
Everybody loves to quote that. And I, rewatching that scene in anticipation of this, I still don't know whether I feel that it's just horribly reductive. I'm sure it's genuinely meant to be a laugh line. I find her character so annoying. That's my thing. Yeah. The character is so annoying. When everything is going down and Scarlett to like take point on that, I don't think you should want to slap that character as much as you want to, but maybe that's the point. I'm not really sure.
I think that was a moment where they were trying to really, we constantly have to see Scarlett overcoming things that she has either never done or was not intended to do. And that is one of them. I do hate that scene because Butterfly McQueen's voice is just so annoying. If they had somebody whose voice wasn't in like freaking Mariah Carey octave range, then it might not have been so bad.
Essentially the Jennifer Tilly of 1939. A lot of people say the slavery element, and it's why we say that the movie does play up this concept of the noble South.
Yeah.
The noble Confederacy. You're not supposed to be rooting for the North, really. You're supposed to be finding this love and this romanticism for the antebellum South. Maybe because of how things are right now in our political landscape, in our country, it leaves me with an icky feeling more so than it usually does. And I don't know if that's just because of current events. And I know a lot of people say, oh, something like, it's the time period. Once a time period where a movie about the KKK were the heroes, that was cool. No, it really wasn't cool. People knew it wasn't cool. They just didn't say anything. Watching this, the movie doesn't try to get political-ish.
No.
But it's still really hard to shake away the fact that you're really supposed to find the South, this era of gentility and mint juleps and all that. You're supposed to find the romantic elements romantic.
What's interesting for me, looking back at it, I always feel like in many ways, it's one of the few films that you get where it's the loser of a war gets to tell you their side in a way. I don't agree with the film's depiction of slavery. I'm able to love the movie and also address that. But I do think that there is something to be said for how this war affected these people. You see them all so happy at that barbecue, which, by the way, I visited that house. Is actually in Culver City, now Culver Studios, so I've been there. They were all so happy at the beginning, and then it's like shit hit the fan. And now their women are being left to fend for themselves. They're throwing these lavish parties, but it's like everybody has to donate their jewelry to fund the war effort. Terra is a mess. All these people are dead in the street. Scarlet and Rhett are resourceful enough and epic enough to get through that, but it's showing you that what was happening to those people. So it's very much a depiction of the Noble South, but it's also like, these are people too.
It's really fun to watch this movie in terms of it's trying to get you to find something majestic about the South. And it's really easy to do that when you have Clark Gable playing Rhett Butler, because he is great. I had seen Clark Gable in other things alongside this. And I always say there are two facets to Clark Gable's career. There's pre-Gone with the Wind and there's post-Gone with the Wind. And post-Gone with the Wind, everything was just kind of a take on Rhett Butler. Pre-Gone with the Wind, though, Clark Gable used to play a lot of colorful characters. He used to play villains. He played some straight-up dicks in his movies back in the 30s. Anybody watch Night Nurse and Red Dust? Pre-code Clark Gable is my favorite thing in the world because his characters just exuded this sexual magnetism, but he was super evil. He's always grinning. He's that precursor to an action hero who's always got a really bad idea brewing, but you're kind of taken with it. He's the one person that, yeah, some of his methods with Scarlett are like a father spanking a child and really all that that implies. But it's really hard not to be drawn into his magnetism.
I think that they are the perfect pair, the two of them in this movie. And Rhett is perfect for Scarlett. Scarlett just doesn't realize it because she's got Ashley freaking Wilkes goggles on. He's messy too. He is not afraid to lean into the fact that Rhett is a scoundrel. He's basically a war profiteer, and Rhett is like, but like, who cares? But from that comes this genuine, I think, love with him and Scarlett. He feels like that's a perfect match for him, and in many ways she is. The scenes where he's talking to the southern generals who have come to Scarlett's house, and he just lets them have it, and he's like, well, I can help you. He's very capable. And my favorite scene is the scene where he easily figures out that Scarlett is there just to get money from him when she's in the curtains. Once again, my one issue with the movie is involving a decision that his character makes, but
discuss that before we get into Ashley Wilkes hatred. There is, why don't you set up the scene?
It's very hard to set it up because I tend to scan over that when I watch the movie. Where it's like, in the way that they have set it up, is supposed to be like, they're having this argument, and Rhett's character is quote-unquote seduces Scarlett after this moment, but in reality, it really just feels like conjugal rape.
The term conjugal rape is created with this movie. They're having this argument, and he just sweeps her up, and they go up the stairs, and she's just fighting, and then just stops moving her arms at a certain point. And she wakes up the next morning smiling. We'll contrast this with a scene from another movie that you brought up, which is Streetcar. Streetcar has a scene where Kim Hunter's Stella is talking about how violent and horrible Stanley is, played by Marlon Brando, but she mentions how when he gets worked up like that, and whatever happens after happens, he gets angry, they have sex, and she's totally okay with it. She's turned on by that. You cannot make that same argument here.
You bring up the Streetcar, and it's also that scene where Stanley is trying to quote-unquote seduce Blanche. I just think the Vivian Leigh, man, she two perfect roles, because that feels very much like a commentary on Gone with the Wind. Like, the moment in Gone with the Wind is so weird.
Because there's really no other way to take it. They're having this argument. She's not into it. It's obvious to see that she doesn't want to go upstairs with him.
Yeah.
And the movie says, oh, that's okay. And again, people have used the argument that in that time period, you couldn't technically rape your wife because it wasn't a legal thing.
Yeah.
And to that I say, wait, what? Yes, I'm aware that that wasn't a thing, but it still doesn't make that point good.
Doesn't mean that we can't understand it now.
And I think the movie understands that what's going on. I mean, the music swells. You're meant to see that something is changing. And then, of course, the next morning, she's like smiling and giddy. And you're like, wait, so it all worked out in the end. No, that's the one part where I'm just, nope, I'm not into it.
That's the one part of the movie that really bums me out, because I think it is perfect otherwise, as messy as some of the other parts are. But it's like, you get to there and you're just, one, you're like, why is Rhett doing this? He did not seem to be this type of person. Why are they shooting it this way? I mean, the staircase is lovely.
her red dress looks really great against it. And
yeah, I mean, they look great. It's perfectly framed, but it's just a weird moment. Yeah, and then to have her wake up so happy the next day is just like, okay.
Like, I have no doubts of Clark Gable or Rhett Butler's prowess, but yeah. I'm pretty sure he wouldn't have had to do that because he's Clark Gable, so I'm not really seeing that.
You know, we brought up the feminist film thing, and I think that this is really just the one area where I think the movie misses the mark at the story that it's trying to tell. If she was a little more mirthful, maybe she was still in the Kim Stanley mode, but she was definitely just like, that was kind of fucked up.
I'm not buying it, but yeah. I can understand the arguments to and fro on that better than I can the arguments against Ashley Wilkes. Ashley Wilkes is Scarlett's original love, the guy that she's into. Yes. And I don't know how he's written in the book, because again, I haven't read the book, but in the movie, much like Melanie, if Rhett Butler is supposed to represent the rascally... Is he supposed to represent the Yankees or the Confederates? I forget.
He's sort of a man out of time.
If he's supposed to represent the future, probably. Ashley Wilkes is supposed to represent the boring, blah, ugh, lumpy, drippy, yeah, South, I'm assuming.
Boring, blah are great descriptions of Ashley Wilkes.
And it doesn't help that you got Leslie Howard. Now, I know Leslie Howard died in the war and he's a hero, but I have never seen a movie, and now somebody can tell me I'm watching the wrong movies, I have never seen a movie where Leslie Howard has actually made me say he's a good actor. I find him to always play the same blah, boring, drippy, milquetoast guy. I love the fact that he said he's not going to try to do an American accent, so he's English in this movie, even though he's supposed to be dyed-in-the-wool Confederate, born in the South. I'm not buying it. He is the Peter Lawford of this movie. Only Peter Lawford was able to make that English accent work, even when he was playing an All-American football hero. I do not get the love for Ashley Wilkes, because I don't get the love for Leslie Howard. I don't think Leslie Howard does anything good in this movie, acting-wise. He's not charismatic. No. He's not charming. He's really almost like a corpse walking around the entire movie. So you're not really understanding how a woman with as much life and spirit in her as Scarlett,
yeah,
is going to find this attractive, other than the fact maybe it's like the fact that he's not into her. I don't know.
It is one of the more frustrating things about Scarlett's character, because you're like, girl, he is awful. He is trash. He's boring. He's blah. He can't commit to you. Meanwhile, Rhett is over here being like, we could be trash together, and that is the perfect match. It's so frustrating because she just keeps trying to go back to him. But then on the flip side, it's very, very fascinating to have that kind of character in this, because he seemingly can't make up his mind. They have this weird push and pull, him and Scarlett. He gives her just enough to keep her coming back. And then it's, yeah, like, oh no, I can't do it.
There's a whole paper to be written about how Ashley Wilkes is the ultimate tease in this movie. Because he's like, I can't be with you, but I'm still going to hang out. Like, we can be friends, kind of-ish. I'm going to flirt with you, but it's totally going to be friend-zoned. And you have poor Olivia de Havilland, who is too good for him, just sitting here in the corner being like, it's okay.
It's a very interesting love sort of square quadrangle thing. But, you know, Olivia de Havilland's character realizing just the type of stress that Scarlett is under and the type of woman that Scarlett is, you have her trying to like protect Scarlett because maybe she sees something in Scarlett that she can't have, but she doesn't see the fact that her husband just cannot not try and be wrapped up in Scarlett's web. Oh my God, that character is so frustrating.
I have seen many a movie with Leslie Howard in it, and the movies are good. But he's just always that same guy.
And he's so weaselly. I think I like his bad performance in this because it continually has you yelling at the screen at Scarlett to stop making these foolish decisions and to grow up a little bit. And particularly when her and Rhett finally get together and you're just like, oh my God, again.
It's funny how many people in this cast didn't like who they were playing. Clark Gable didn't want to do this, but he had to so that he could get a divorce and marry Carol Lombard. Butterfly McQueen hated playing Prissy because of how the character is stereotyped. And Leslie Howard didn't like the role of Ashley Wilkes because he felt he was too old, which he was.
Which he was, yeah.
And he said that the costumes, quote, made him look like a fairy doorman at a hotel.
Which he did.
And I'm sitting here thinking, well, Leslie, they must have offered you a ridiculously good deal because you did take the role. Then again, they were forced to in the 30s, you know, contractually. You did what the studio told you to do. It's remarkable how, whether you love or hate the movie, most people will agree Leslie Howard is the worst part.
In some ways that the movie is designed for that. It's just her blind spot. And we're sitting there as viewers being like, you married the old man to get the money, which is totally fine. We are here for that. You've now got Rhett, who's got money and is just a scoundrel and shady as you. And yet you still want what you think is the good guy, Ashley Wilkes. I think it partly starts off because she couldn't have him at the beginning. He was pledged to marry somebody else. And then she stole her sister's man away from her. And so she thought that maybe she could steal Ashley. But I think it's by design that we are not supposed to like that guy in performance or in the writing.
And again, somebody can tell me that if I watch this Leslie Howard movie, I'll get it. But I haven't seen one so far. This was the movie that won the Oscar in 1939. First color film. Still, I think to this date, the longest film to win Best Picture in terms of runtime.
How long is Lawrence of Arabia might be just under the time? I did not care for that movie.
But a lot of great movies were released in 1939. The Academy Awards ceremony that year was just insane for Best Picture. We're complaining right now about the wrong movies being nominated for Academy Awards. Yeah. And I can't really complain with a lot of the movies nominated for Best Picture in 1939. You had Dark Victory, which I love Dark Victory, one of my favorite Bette Davis movies. I know a lot of people say it's maudlin, but I love it. Goodbye, Mr. Chips, which I still have to see. Love Affair, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Ninotchka, Of Mice and Men, Stagecoach, The Wizard of Oz, and Wuthering Heights. This one. I'm biased, so I would naturally say that I would have given my money towards Wuthering Heights.
Ugh.
I am a huge Wuthering Heights fan, and I know Vivian Leigh's husband, Laurence Olivier, is in Wuthering Heights, but I don't know, that one always works for me. Not a fan.
No, I hate Wuthering Heights.
Terrence, I think that ruins our friendship a little bit.
I do think that is one of the best picture lineups the Academy has ever put together. It definitely represents where cinema was, where cinema was going, and the best of that year. Gone with the Wind ended up, it technically won 8 and then got 2 additional. So it's at a grand total of 10. Second most all time, along with West Side Story.
That's another one that I really enjoy.
Yes, both have interesting depictions of so-called race.
Interesting race relations in that movie. 1939 is considered the best year for the film industry up until that point. But it was also the studio saying goodbye to the silent era, because if memory serves, didn't the burning of Atlanta, that was just them burning all their old silent film sets.
Well, the fire got a little bit out of control.
They had transitioned from silent into not just talkies, but color, and we're just like, screw that. We don't really need these anymore. They cleared the studio backlot, including sets from 1936's The Garden of Allah and the Great Wall set from King Kong. It wasn't silent films, but essentially those early sound films. Very funny to know what got ruined. Also sad, because I love King Kong, and I think that Great Wall set. Terrence, I think you've convinced me a little bit not to hate Gone with the Wind.
No, don't hate it.
I would not put it in my... I mean, if we're going technical mastery, okay, yeah, it's up there.
Yeah.
In terms of personal favorites, it's still not up there. As I said in the beginning, it's beautiful to look at. It's well acted, but there are some issues that I have with it.
Walked you back from hate. So we're getting there, you know. We'll do another podcast about this in like a couple of years, and by then you'll probably love it.
I promise that we will find a classic film that Terrence and I both agree on one day in the future.
Yeah, it's definitely not Lawrence of Arabia.
No, I still need to watch that. Let me know your thoughts on Gone with the Wind. You can email your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and I can read them on the next episode. If you can want to tell me that I'm completely wrong and Gone with the Wind is a masterpiece, or if you agree with me, I will read anything. I'd like to thank, once again, Terrence Johnson for joining me today. Terrence, where can fans find and get in touch with you?
You can get in touch with me on Twitter, mostly, at LenoirAuteur. That's LenoirAuteur. I'm writing at LenoirAuteur.net and Screen Rant.
That'll close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, please consider helping out the podcast by leaving a rating and review. As always, you can contact me directly with film suggestions, questions, or comments at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also now on Twitter, at ticklish_biz. Want to listen to episodes early or have me review your favorite film? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making this podcast the premier classic film show out there. If you're interested in becoming a patron, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Next time, look for a special TCM Classic Film Festival episode with guest Kelly Kitchens, who's going to kick off a 3-episode presentation of TCM Classic Film Festival audio from festivals past and present. Till next time.